It's 12:06 and time for another edition of Health 360 here on WBOY. Good afternoon, I'm Sarah D'Elia. If you'd like to join today's conversation, give us a call at 260-452-1185, post on our Facebook page Midday Matters, or email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm. Coming a little bit later on our program today, we'll be discussing glaucoma, the treatment, causes, and care for the eye disease. We'll have Dr. William Argus from the Fort Wayne Glaucoma Center to help answer your questions. But for now, I'm happy to introduce Abby Harvey and Ron Whetstone from Lutheran Hospital's Critical Care Transport Team. Abby is a nurse and paramedic, and Ron is the man flying the helicopter that we all probably hear all throughout Fort Wayne. Thank you so much for coming in today, guys. And we're going to be discussing Lutheran Hospital's Critical Care Transport Team and what that all entails. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, Abby, I want to start off with you. What is your job exactly? You're a nurse and you're a paramedic, and I know that you're riding inside the helicopter while Ron is flying and keeping you safe. But tell me a little bit about your background, when you became a nurse, and what made you decide that you wanted to be a part of flying and the transport team?
Sure. I'd like to share that. I became a nurse 12 years ago, and my experience was working in the ICU there at Lutheran Hospital. And I was around when Lutheran Air started in 2004, and I became very interested in the critical care transport aspect of it. And, you know, I looked forward to a challenge, mm-hmm. increasing my knowledge base and being part of a superior team. And so part of why I became a paramedic is because being on the ICU nursing side of it, it is a little different once you get into that transport role. So to become more familiar with the type of situations I would see more in the critical care transport section of patient care, mm-hmm. I went ahead and got my EMT and went on for my paramedic in 2007.
Wow, right. And we were talking a little bit about the show, what exactly decided to make the huge transition into having your day be in a helicopter and transporting folks. And you talked a little bit about the adrenaline and kind of the rush that you have with that work. And I was hoping you could expand a little bit more on that.
Sure. You know, it is an exciting job. It is, it's filled full of adrenaline, and it is very, that short amount of time that you're with that patient, mm-hmm. you know, preparing, you know, getting the call, getting ready, you know, all the things that we have to do to be safe, just getting to our patient is a lot that maybe a lot of people don't realize. You know, there's a lot of safety factors we have to be cautious about, being around a helicopter and flying in the helicopter and assisting our pilot and making sure that our crew's getting there safely. Mm-hmm. So that part of it, that's, you know, a lot of the adrenaline rush, and then, you know, taking care of that sick patient. You know, they are, in most cases, very critical, and, you know, that adds to that, you know, and then combining all that, bringing that patient back to where he or she needs the care, mm. you know, and doing it safely and giving the patient the best care possible. Mm.
And Ron, I want to ask you the same question. What made you passionate about this type of work that you're doing? I know you mentioned that you've been flying for over 30 years, so obviously you like it, you enjoy it. But what is it about this, that being a part of the transportation team, that is fulfilling?
A lot of it just has to deal with the interaction of the crew members. It's fun to drive the plane, so to speak, but the real enjoyment of the job comes from, you know, every day you're going to work with a group of people who are very motivated, relatively high performing. You're really trying to bring the hospital to the patient rather than wait till they get to the hospital to start administering the higher levels of care that we now know provide better survivability in most instances. I started flying almost by accident early in my career, and I found that I enjoyed flying so much that I've just pursued it one way or the other. Here in Fort Wayne, it's been a good ride, as we say. I started just 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was working on other jobs, and when the economy started to get slower, I'd been on the road for several years with numerous jobs, and golly, there was a nice little seat sitting down there at Lutheran. they needed a pilot at the time, and I came to work for them. It's been a lot of fun. It's always challenging in that you're not just flying. You're trying to bring safety and professionalism to the rest of the team. And of course, most of the other team members are long in a medical background. Some of them have never flown before they hop on the helicopter as a crew member. So it's nice to integrate both those functions.
I imagine that could be, I mean, you could be the best nurse in the world in the hospital, and then you step into a helicopter that is going through possible turbulence because of the weather and just not as stable as the floor. I imagine that you must be a calming presence in the helicopter, or have to be, to kind of keep everybody level-headed.
We try to be. You know, first and foremost, when we get to location, the people taking care of that patient have probably already determined that he needs more than they can give. Mm-hmm. So right off the bat, they are spring-loaded to want to send this patient on, be it in a local ER or on the scene. We do scene runs. Mm. So we may be the second or third unit out to an accident or injury site with horrific consequences for somebody. And at the same time, we're trying to bring a sense of calm and knowledge to the situation. We are not involved in the rescue, but our goal then is to take some of the load off the local people who are rescuing so that they know that the best medical care available is there. And even though that's not what they're thinking at the time, that's our job to be able to step in and let them deal with just the rescue, and we have patient care, so they no longer need to worry about patient care. They can just do their job.
260-452-1185 is the number to call if you have any questions or comments, or you can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm. We're talking with Abby Harvey. She is a nurse and paramedic, as well as Ron Whetstone. He is a pilot. They're both from Lutheran Hospital's critical care transport team. Abby, I wanted to ask you, how bad does a situation have to be for you all to get involved to transport somebody? I mean, it feels like these are extremely critical injuries where what's been happening, the treatment, the course isn't working, and something else has to happen, and someone has to go somewhere different. What's the process of getting that call and knowing what kind of condition that person is in?
That's a great question. Most of our flights are to rural hospitals, and those patients that come in there that are sick, that are needing care, they find themselves, having great treatment with the physicians and the staffs in those ERs. But there are some cases that patients are critical enough and they don't have the resources to, let's say, for example, a patient comes in having a heart attack, and the best thing for that patient is to get to a cath lab. And not all of those hospitals have those resources. So in those cases, those physicians will contact our hospital. Mm-hmm. And what they do and how they do that is there's one number that they call, and they call into that line. They reach a dispatch person, and they take the information, and the decision to transport is then decided once those physicians make contact and talk about that patient and the care that is needed, and mm-hmm. if it's appropriate, which, in most cases it generally is. And then what happens from there is that dispatch person then contacts us by a pager. There's a radio that we carry around with all of us, and we get toned out. And then that's how the process starts for us. Mm. So a lot of times we're getting the call, and there's still information coming in about that patient that they don't have enough to give us right then, but they know that we're needed, and we go ahead and we lift off and mm-hmm. head towards that hospital, knowing that that patient's being accepted and the care is needed to be transferred.
And you all serve, I think, a 150-mile radius around Fort Wayne. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. What's the longest that you're generally, or what's a long time for being in the air for you? Because I feel like you're going very fast, so probably not as long as it looks to a somebody peering up into the sky. Do you want to take that one, Ron?
Our longer usual flights are to Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. We find a lot of our patients from this region, if they are looking for the higher level of care, they would be going down to one of the larger hospitals in Indianapolis. Typically, it takes us from this area about 40 minutes. to Indianapolis. In fact, that is part of our planning as a pilot. We keep a fuel load on board the aircraft, being able to run out to one of our furthest local hospitals, which is usually up north, and then take that patient to Indianapolis and then go get fuel. That is my first concern, mm-hmm. is, you know, I have to be able to take the patient to where he needs to go, and then I still have to go get fuel after that. So that's my planning circumstance. And we keep enough fuel to reach our furthest hospital locally, mm-hmm. which is usually within 50. So most of our flights will be out 20 minutes to a local hospital, mm-hmm. pick up the patient, return them to Fort Wayne. Several times a month, we'll then need to take a patient to a higher level of care beyond Fort Wayne even, and usually Indianapolis. To the tune of once, twice a year, we'll run a patient over to Cleveland, which is right at 150 miles. Mm-hmm. You know, compared to our average day, boy, you're just sitting in that aircraft forever when you run over there. Mm-hmm. But Cleveland is a popular destination. Some of our younger patients routinely go down to Cincinnati. Mm. I seem to see that once or twice a year, not quite as far. When I first hired on here, I thought I would probably be going to Chicago more often than we do. Mm-hmm. But we've taken a few patients to Chicago with the program since I've been here. I have not yet been to Chicago with this program. Detroit, once in a blue moon.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And you mentioned when you go to those places that are, you know, longer than a 20-minute ride, it kind of takes up the whole day. And I didn't realize, I mean, it makes sense how much planning has to go into your day between fuel, getting there, coming back to turn around and go to the next place. Is there any ever, do you have a mechanic on board, or do you have those mechanical skills yourself, or if there's ever something that's physically wrong with the helicopter, or how do you address those issues?
No, we don't carry a mechanic per se. To be honest, most of the weight and seats in the aircraft are taken up by necessary people, be it the patient or crew. We do have a mechanic dedicated to the program. He's on call 24/7, so to speak. Fortunately, the company has a number of backup people to give him some relief. With this size of aircraft, typically one mechanic can keep up with it. And he's augmented occasionally. We'll bring in temporary help when we get a lot of maintenance due. Mm-hmm. The company also provides for Lutheran Air a backup aircraft. So when our physical aircraft has a major inspection or a major problem, usually within a short period of time, we can get a secondary aircraft in here, so the crew will go right on flying in the backup aircraft, and our main aircraft then gets its maintenance. Typically, once a year, we're down for a significant amount of time, a week or so, for maintenance, and we'll be in a scheduled backup. And then anytime the aircraft breaks and we can't fix it immediately, we'll look at getting a backup in here to keep the program going.
We're going to need to take a short break here on Health 360, but we'll be back in just a moment. Questions, comments, give us a call, 260-452-1185. Post on our Facebook page or send us an email, middaymatters@nipr.fm.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear conversations with entertaining people like Nancy Cartwright, the voice of Bart Simpson.
I gave him one take, one sound, one voice, and that was it.
Blah, 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 blah.
And Matt, his eyebrows went up, his tongue came out of his mouth. He's like, oh my God, that's him, that's Bart, that's him. You got the part.
The most interesting people in show business tell their stories on Fresh Air.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Prison is lonely. The last thing my lawyer said to me before I was about to go in was, Piper, don't make any friends. And something you hear again and again when you're locked up, you walk in here alone and you walk out alone.
Join us for the Moth Radio Hour, true stories told live from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Wednesday nights at 9 here on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com. Support for this program on WBOI is provided by United Way of Allen County, offering opportunities to volunteer and make an impact on a child's life by mentoring or tutoring. UWEducationNetwork.org.
Welcome back to Health 360 here on WBOI. The time is 12:22. I'm Sarah D'Elia. If you have any questions or comments, 260-452-1185 is the number to call. Or you can post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm. Just about 10 minutes left in this first half of our program today. We have Abby Harvey. She's a nurse and paramedic, as well as Ron Whetstone. He is a pilot. They're both involved in Lutheran Hospital's critical care transport team. And they're the ones flying, or, well, Ron is the one flying the helicopter, and Abby is the one taking care of the patients and keeping everyone stable in the helicopters that we hear buzzing around throughout town. Thank you both so much for being here. And Abby, I wanted to hear a little bit more from you. I'm really fascinated by both of your jobs. I think they're very cool, and I'm glad to be in the position that I am in today to get to ask you a bunch of interesting questions about it. What's the biggest challenge that you've faced? What surprised you working on a helicopter?
Well, I guess the biggest challenge is, not all patients have great outcomes. And just like an ICU nurse, an ER nurse, any kind of nurse, home hospice nurse, you face those challenges where you have to come to terms with what you can't control. And that's the biggest challenge, I think. It's the hardest thing to overcome, mm-hmm. being a nurse overall or being a paramedic, any type of caregiver. So that's the biggest challenge. As far as what is surprising, I guess, I always thought I wanted to be or always knew that I wanted to be a flight nurse, as soon as I got into nursing and got into the ICU role and learned more about that, the flight nursing. So I guess what was the most surprising to me was that it is different than riding in an airplane. It is quite a different ride, and there's a lot more to our roles in being in that, partaking in the safety aspect. So, which is the greatest part of it, and the closeness of the team, that we do come together. We are very close. And I think that's what makes us a great team. So.
And Ron, I'll ask you the same thing. What challenges have you encountered in your day-to-day being the pilot for the critical care transport team, and what surprised you?
Biggest challenge, as probably with most of aviation, is complacency. We do the same easy task over and over again. Mm. We combine several of those to make out our day. But particularly in EMS, where you have a lot of standby time, you find you may give routine attention to everything you do, but it's that one time, not once a year, but once every 10 years in your career, where preparations for the aircraft, you do the same old stuff, but you have to realize not everything you look at brings meaning to today. So every day you try to go out and do those tasks. That human nature is to do the same thing over and over. Repetitive brings consistency. Mm-hmm. But they found in aviation that's generally true, but you're looking for that 1 in 100,000 change. So every day you have to find new ways to try to look at what it is you're looking for, be it pre-flight where you're looking at the same piece of equipment, but you have to ask. It's almost too tedious for the human body to look at the same piece of equipment over and over again for years, and pretty soon you get to see what's not there.
Right.
So while it's nice to do it the same every day, you have to realize, gee, if I look at this a different way, what does that bring to it? So when I'm not busy, looking for motivation to try to go out and see, okay, have I looked at it this way? Sometimes just changing order helps. You need to distinguish that then from your rush tasks, which are what you'll do to get the aircraft off the ground. They found typically you don't want to continue to do that the same, but if you change order, it will put you out of order, and it leads to problems. So trying to satisfy both of those masters to change and make interesting the routine when necessary, and then recognizing those tasks that need to be done in the same order, in the same way, every day. And sometimes you give them names just to make it interesting.
Interesting. And anything that's really surprised you while on the job besides not going to Chicago and flying there as much?
No. It's I flew EMS many years ago. I worked for the state for a while and came back to EMS to live here in Fort Wayne. It's been a great ride. It's a kind of a small town compared to the major cities, but really doesn't have the traffic problems that you experience there. And we see that in the air, too, you know, going into a major city from a flight perspective. You take for granted you're going to come off your little hospital and go trucking along without much other air traffic to be concerned with. Going into some of the major hubs and Cleveland particularly, you're going right down the runway for Cleveland International Airport. So you have to realize you're in a much busier terminal airspace area.
I have just one more question for both of you before we have to say goodbye. Abby, you've alluded to some of the challenges when working on a helicopter where safety is involved, things that you have to keep in mind that if you're in a hospital and you're not moving, you don't have to worry about necessarily. I'm interested as to what some of those challenges are that you encounter in your day-to-day.
Right. A lot of those challenges are, weather, being safe, not slipping and falling on the ice to get to the aircraft. And then, being very vigilant about, checking your equipment, making sure what you have is there. Because when we're out at, when we're up in the air, we don't have a lot of resources. We have what we have packed and that's it. So, being consistent about the process of how we check our equipment. We do a lot of training for assisting the pilots with, radio communications and watching for other aircraft. And, just the simplest things, making sure doors are shut and that things aren't hanging out the doors and, latching equipment properly. So, it's a lot of those little things that seem so unnecessary, but they're important. And, if you're not careful, like he said, complacency can really lead to a disaster. Mm-hmm. So, you have to be constantly thinking about what could go wrong and always be on top of things. Mm-hmm. So, and that's not just for preparation of getting your patient, but, also with the patient, thinking forward and thinking ahead.
Mm-hmm. And interesting, I like the point that you made, thinking about yourselves, how much supplies you have for your own self. I mean, if you're going to have to be making rounds back and forth, I mean, it isn't like an airplane. There's not a ton of room where you can store a lot of stuff. That's planning is just really key, I bet.
Mm-hmm. It is. It absolutely is.
And Ron, I'll let you have the last word, ending on safety and what you have to keep in mind with your day-to-day, besides the routine checking, anything that would our listeners would find interesting from taking off to landing?
Oh, golly, anything interesting? what I do is so boring.
It's really not. It's quite interesting.
It is. Many times, once we get departed and en route to someplace, we have a minute to take a breath, and I find myself looking around and enjoying the ride. And that's the better part of aviation. I've always thought of, as people ask me the differences between flying an airplane and a helicopter, I tell them that if an airplane is like driving a car, and there are several similarities, than flying a helicopter is like riding a motorcycle. Mm. You know, it's the same roads, same traffic rules, same limits, but there's an element of balance. There's an additional personal physical sense with the helicopter. And it's a very different job. But flying both is enjoyable, and by and large, every time I think about a career change, I realize there's really nothing else I could have fun with.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for being a part of Health 360 today.
Thank you.
We need to take a quick break for the news here on WBOY, but we'll be back with more of Health 360 in just a few moments.
How do you turn earthquake wreckage into art?
It's like a giant array of rusted rebar, steel rebar poles.
In this kind of undulating shape.
Almost as if it's an earthquake, as if the quake is waving through the gallery floors.
A new work from Chinese dissident artist Ai Weiwei, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered airs weekday afternoons at 4 on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Good afternoon, I'm Sean Beter with WBOY News. Fiscal restraint was the theme last night as Governor Mike Pence delivered his first State of the State address to the Indiana General Assembly. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Dan Goldblatt reports, Pence made his case for a budget some in his own party think is too lean.
Pence took to the podium with the goal of convincing legislators and Hoosiers across the state that a 10% income tax cut is a fiscally responsible move. Pence says since the state is bringing in more than it spends, it should leave some of that money in Hoosiers' pockets.
I think the government budget should never grow faster than the family budget. And our budget is a full percentage point less than inflation. By holding the line on spending, Indiana can continue to stand out as a beacon of fiscal restraint, a state that knows how to fund its priorities in a responsible way.
Pence also called for a reduction in state regulations that he says stunt economic growth.
That's why on day one of our administration, I signed a moratorium on any new regulations to ensure that Indiana is not burdening Hoosier employers with unnecessary red tape.
The governor also reached out to military families, calling for at least 3% of all state contracts awarded to go to veteran-owned businesses. On education, he says he will work with State Superintendent Glenda Ritz to give teachers more freedom in the classroom. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Dan Goldblatt.
The chairman of the Indiana Senate's Education Committee says he's working on a compromise to a bill that would pull the state from the Common Core State Standards National Education Initiative. Hundreds of Common Core opponents attended a state house rally last week ahead of a committee hearing on whether the state should retain the math and reading standards adopted by the State Board of Education in 2010. Republican Senator Dennis Cruz says he'll wait until at least next week before holding a vote on the bill. Cruz says a compromise could call for more State Board of Education public hearings and possibly blend the Common Core and previous state benchmarks. The Indiana Chamber of Commerce and other Common Core supporters say the State Board of Education should decide school standards. And Ball State University will not renew the charters of 7 schools in Fort Wayne, Gary, Indianapolis, and Richmond for the 2013-2014 academic year. The authorizer has been under scrutiny since a Stanford study concluded Indiana charter students would have made bigger gains over the last decade if not for a handful of low-performing schools authorized by Ball State. State Impact Indiana's Ellie Moxley has more.
All of the schools whose charters Ball State University didn't renew received a D or an F in the state's accountability system last year. But so did 5 of the 11 schools Ball State will continue to authorize. Bob Mara is executive director of the Office of Charter Schools.
We believe that these schools can be successful, and so what we have done is put into performance conditions to address those concerns, and that's why we gave them a shorter period of time.
Mara says the decision to renew the charters came from the school's academic, financial, and organizational performance. Ball State didn't renew the charters of Charter School of the Dunes and Lead College Preparatory School in Gary, Imagine Indiana Life Sciences Academy East in Indianapolis, Imagine Master Academy, Imagine Schools on Broadway, and the Timothy L. Johnson Academy in Fort Wayne, and Kenneth A. Chrisman STEM Leadership Academy in Richmond. Schools had the opportunity to present additional information to Ball State about student performance when they reapplied. At least one of the schools whose charter wasn't renewed was surprised by Ball State's decision. Michael Nicholson is president of the board of directors for the Timothy L. Johnson Academy.
We had, in fact, in October, had just recently talked with the university about our renewal for another 3-year period.
Schools have 10 days to appeal Ball State's decision. Nicholson says his school will likely try to find a new sponsor. For State Impact Indiana, I'm Ellie Moxley.
You're listening to Midday Matters Health 360 here on 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Health 360 here on WBOI. The time is 12:37. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 260-452-1185. Post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or you can always send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio by Dr. William Argus from the Fort Wayne Glaucoma Center to help answer your questions this half of the show. We're going to be talking about treatment, causes, and care for the eye disease, so thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
So let's start off. What is glaucoma exactly, and how would you define it for the average person?
Glaucoma is a group of diseases that is characterized by elevated pressure. Anyone can get that. And if the pressure goes too high in an eye, it can cause visual loss.
Interesting. And when we're having our routine eye exam, how is the eye doctor, which test is for glaucoma? Is there one that we're routinely being screened for when we're getting our eyes examined?
Every routine eye exam includes a measurement of pressure.
Okay.
Some people use an air puff machine, and others use a blue light where they actually place a little instrument on the eye itself, which contacts the cornea and measures the pressure inside the eye.
Okay, so that's the fun test where your chin is kind of strapped in and you get the...
That's right.
Okay, so whenever I shriek back and...
Yes.
Okay, that means that I'm good, so that's good to know. What are some of the symptoms for some of our listeners that maybe have a family history or are worried about getting glaucoma? What are some of the symptoms that folks should keep in mind?
Well, there are several types of glaucoma, and some acute glaucomas are very symptomatic. They cause pain, redness, loss of vision, halos, and that is a medical emergency that must be taken care of. But most of the time, it's a silent problem. Mm. Most people don't have symptoms, and the goal of glaucoma is preventative care.
Okay, well, let's get into preventative care. What should our listeners be keeping in mind to not have to worry about glaucoma in the future?
In general, just a routine eye exam every few years to make sure that the pressure is under control. One also looks at the optic nerve head inside the eye. The retina, of course, the eye can be thought of as a camera, where the lens focuses the light on the retina, and the retina is the film in your eye's camera.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have a good film, and then the information is transmitted back to the brain via the optic nerve. So we look at the optic nerve because that's where the damage in glaucoma comes. So there are some people that have elevated pressure at times other than when they're in the eye doctor's office. And so if we look at the optic nerve and it doesn't look healthy, if it looks like it's been damaged by glaucoma, then further testing is usually ordered.
Okay. What's the treatment for glaucoma? If it comes back that somebody does have it, what are the first steps that a doctor will take on the patient?
Generally, the treatment is, of course, to lower the pressure. Occasionally, it is an anatomical problem, and a minor surgery with a laser will take care of the issue. But most of the time, it is a problem with the fluid circulation in the eye. Should probably back up a little bit. I like to say that in Indiana, we like to talk about basketballs, and basketballs need pressure to bounce.
Mm-hmm.
And there are also a few structures inside your eye that do not have blood vessels, and they get nourishment from the fluid that circulates inside your eye. So there is a fluid circulation, and there is a pressure in the normal circumstance. Mm-hmm. In general, in glaucoma, we're talking about obstruction of that fluid circulation. And so the goal is to either increase the drainage or to turn down the faucet. And that's usually done initially with eye drops.
Okay. That sounds simple enough. But we were talking a little bit about the show. There are all types of glaucoma, so from the acute to the more severe. So if eye drops aren't working, that's not part of the solution. What are some of the more, invasive steps that someone might have to undergo?
Usually, if we're not able to control the pressure, we will do a trabeculectomy, where we make a small incision in the eye, mm-hmm. which basically forms a new drain. Those have been very successful with the advent of some chemotherapeutic agents that we use to minimize the scarring. When those fail, we place a tube inside the eye to drain the fluid.
And let's talk a little bit about you mentioned that anyone can get glaucoma, but are there folks that are more eligible to get it? Does family history, smoking, that kind of thing play a role in if somebody is going to get glaucoma?
Family history plays a major role in the inherited glaucomas. There are some congenital glaucomas that people pass down to their children. But most glaucomas are idiopathic. They just happen randomly in our population.
Mm. What about smoking? Does that elevate you or put you at a greater risk if you are a smoker for glaucoma?
Smoking is not known to affect glaucoma, but it does affect macular degeneration and your overall health.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. And is it a guarantee that if somebody has glaucoma and it's fairly serious that they will go blind? I know that's a lot of people fear that that's going to be a reality for them if that's their diagnosis.
If it is treated, visual loss can usually be prevented.
Okay. How long can... I'm sure that you would advise someone to immediately get assistance if they had glaucoma, but how long, and I'm sure this might be a case-by-case basis, but how long would it take somebody to go blind because of glaucoma?
That depends on how high their pressure is.
Okay.
The normal pressure is around 10 to 20. If someone's pressure is 60, they will lose vision within a few months usually.
Wow.
50, probably within a year or so. 40, it may take 5 or 10 years,
mm-hmm. and
so on.
I imagine that's irreversible blindness.
Usually when damage has occurred, mm-hmm. that damage is not reversible.
Okay.
But the goal is to try to prevent further damage, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 260-452-1185 is the number to call if you have any questions or comments. We're joined in the studio by Dr. William Argus of the Fort Wayne Glaucoma Center, and we're talking about the signs, treatment, and prevention of glaucoma. If you have any questions, please do give us a call, 260-452-1185. And remember, we have our email address that you can write to us, middaymatters@nipr.fm, or you can post on our Facebook page. We're going to take a short break on Health 360, but we'll be back in just a few moments.
So what you're seeing over here is a tortured-looking, adorable little girl looking at the cookie, sniffing at it.
Could your ability to resist the cookie at age 4 predict how successful you will be at age 40?
She's holding her breath. She looks like she's going to explode.
Come on, hold fast. Hold fast. Find out on the next Radiolab. I'm Jad Abumrad. Join me.
Wednesday nights at 10 here on WBOI.
Hello, I'm Claudia Johnson, host of WBOI Presents. Tonight we feature clips from important speeches given in the last 50 years about civil rights. I hope you'll join us tonight as we explore Black history in America. Tonight at 8 on WBOI Presents.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear conversations with entertaining people like Nancy Cartwright, the voice of Bart Simpson.
I gave him one take, one sound, one voice, and that was it.
Blah, 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 blah.
And Matt, his eyebrows went up, his tongue came out of his mouth. He's like, oh my God, that's him, that's Bart, that's him. You got the part.
The most interesting people in show business tell their stories on Fresh Air.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Welcome back to Health 360 here on WBOY 89.1 FM. The time is 12:47. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 260-452-1185. Email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm, or you can post right on our Facebook page. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio for the second half of our program today with Dr. William Argus of the Fort Wayne Glaucoma Center. And again, 260-452-1185 to get your questions and comments in. We talked a little bit about some of the different factors that play into getting glaucoma. Before the break, I wanted to dive into a little bit about age and what role age plays in eye diseases, especially in glaucoma.
Glaucoma is definitely more common in patients over 50 years of age, and especially 60 years of age. Mm-hmm. Angle closure glaucoma is one of the acute glaucomas. And it is most commonly seen over the age of 60. Mm-hmm. But glaucoma can be seen at any age. And like most things, the earlier that you are diagnosed with glaucoma, the more you have to worry about long-term care.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that a lot of folks are referred to you. And let's talk a little bit about the evaluation process when you get a new patient that has the signs or symptoms of glaucoma. I mean, you mentioned that it was a fairly silent disease. So what are you looking for to verify that they do have glaucoma and to begin treatment?
Well, the first thing we try to do is assess what their range of intraocular pressures are. The range is, the normal range is around 10 to 20 or 21, 22. Many patients that we have are referred in with patients with pressures of 25 to 30 or so. We first try to determine how high their pressure is, and then we look at the optic nerve and see how healthy it is, and we look for causes for the elevated pressure. Again, if there is any anatomic problem that needs to be taken care of, or if there are secondary glaucomas, such as exfoliation disease, where flakes of a protein obstruct the drainage ports, or pigmentary glaucoma, where pigment flakes obstruct the drainage ports.
Mm. And folks that are, you know, unfortunately have glaucoma, are these people that typically, you know, wear glasses throughout their lives? I mean, are there those people that had fine vision, but this pressure was building up in their eyes that they just weren't aware of?
That is correct.
Okay, so it can anyone really?
Anyone can get elevated pressure.
Okay. We've talked a little bit about the evaluation process, determining what kind of glaucoma someone has, and I bet depending on whether it's a hereditary form or someone just happens to get it, that the treatment maybe is going to be different depending on what type it is. Is that true?
Generally, the more aggressive the glaucoma, the more aggressive our treatment. Basically, what we try to do is assess risk. And what is the risk that the current pressure is a problem for this patient? And we really have to individualize it for each case. And if we think it's high risk, then we treat. And if we think it's very high risk, then we try to get the pressure as low as we can.
Mm-hmm. Are there any signs for parents that they should be more vigilant on with young children, that their children might be developing glaucoma, besides just taking them in for an annual eye exam? Is there something that parents should be aware of, or, you know, asking their children certain questions to see if they may be developing it?
Juvenile glaucoma is a very uncommon problem. Congenital glaucoma is rare as well. But those children usually have significant tearing, and their eyes actually can begin to enlarge, and so they don't look normal. So somewhere around 8 months of age, people with congenital glaucoma usually seek out a medical opinion, and it is diagnosed that they have very high pressure. It can usually be treated at that level.
260-452-1185, or you can give us a question or a comment at middaymatters@nipr.fm, or you can post right on our Facebook page. I want to talk a little bit about some of the consequences besides blindness that someone may encounter if glaucoma goes untreated. You know, there is blindness and that would not be ideal for anyone, but are there other signs that someone, or other effects that someone may have to learn to live with besides blindness if glaucoma were to go untreated?
You can think of blindness in two different ways. One would be central blindness, which would be the inability to read. The other would be your peripheral vision. So glaucoma usually affects peripheral vision first. So patients will develop a tunnel vision. They can still read, but their peripheral vision is limited, and that's usually the first symptom.
Any other, I wanted to talk a little bit about some kinds of treatments that people might be able to do besides, we've talked a little about the teardrops, we talked a little bit about surgery. Is there any other type of treatment that you recommend for folks that have severe glaucoma?
Laser therapy can be effective at times, but usually the mainstay is eye drops. We have a couple of different types of eye drops that we recommend. Again, we can either turn the faucet down or increase the drain. And some medicines decrease the production of fluid, some open up the drains. And if we have a combination of those two, we can usually keep the pressure under control. It's also nice to know that many years ago, the drops were frequently 3 and 4 times a day, and now many drops are once a day, so compliance is a much, much better, is much better with our patients.
260-452-1185 is the number to call. We have just about 5 minutes left in today's program. You can always send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm, or you can post right on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. We are talking about glaucoma and the signs, the treatment, and any preventative measures that we can take as far as our eye care goes. We have a write-in, an email from a listener that wants to know if they have a relative that has glaucoma. Are they still legally allowed to drive? They haven't had any blindness yet set in, but they have been diagnosed with glaucoma. How safe is it for that person to be driving and on the roads?
Most people with glaucoma, especially early glaucoma, have perfectly normal vision, and it doesn't limit their lifestyle. However, if they do have tunnel vision, their peripheral vision will be limited, so they may not see little children that are darting out in front of them, so they really need to be very careful.
I imagine somebody that has been officially diagnosed with glaucoma will have to undergo routine visits with a doctor. Is that true? What's your post-care kind of like after you're initially diagnosed and maybe treated?
Early glaucoma and well-controlled glaucoma are usually maintained on a yearly visit. More advanced every 6 months. Very advanced disease usually every 3 months.
Okay. 260-452-1185 is the number to call. Questions, comments. We have just about 3 minutes left in today's program. We're talking about glaucoma awareness. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or you can email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio this afternoon with Dr. William Argus of the Fort Wayne Glaucoma Center. We have just a couple minutes left in today's program, and I wanted to ask, have you noticed a typical person that you usually see at the Glaucoma Center in Fort Wayne?
That's a good question. I think glaucoma may be a little bit more common in women. Mm-hmm. And some older women, yes, so it definitely increases with age.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, glaucoma patients come in all shapes and sizes.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed an increase in recent years of folks that have been seeking treatment for glaucoma?
I think it's about the same.
Okay. Any other last-minute advice you could leave for our listeners with general eye care advice or any preventative measures for glaucoma?
Basically, the best thing that you can do is have a good eye exam annually by your eye care professional.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us today for Health 360.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
We're going to take a quick look at the WBOI weather forecast before we get on to Fresh Air with your local host, Katie Anderson. Currently 16 degrees in Fort Wayne. This afternoon, we do have a 20% chance of snow, mostly cloudy and cold. We'll have a high near 18 degrees. Tonight, a chance of snow showers after 1 a.m., then a chance of some flurries before ending. Mostly cloudy, and we'll have a low around 10 degrees. Wind chill values as low as -5 this evening. Looking to Thursday, mostly sunny and quite cold. We'll have a high near 19 degrees along with some large gusts of wind throughout the day. Thursday night, a 50% chance of snow, mainly after 4 a.m. Mostly cloudy, and we'll have a low around 15 degrees. This is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1. We're streaming online at our website, nipr.fm. This is WBOY Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. If you haven't checked out our website yet, it's nipr.fm, and you can click on Midday Matters, where this episode of Midday Matters Health 360 will be podcasted by the end of the day. Again, that's Midday Matters on our website, nipr.fm. This is WBOY Fort Wayne. Thanks very much for listening, and have a good rest of your day.